Well, the last Monday of the month for a long, long time now, our weather guys have stopped by to talk about climate and weather. And at least one of them's here right now. Steve Ackerman's made it. Steve, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences as well. John Martin isn't with us at the moment, but I expect he'll come marching through the door here in a minute or two, John, professor as well in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. There's a lot we can talk about today with them. I know I want to talk about fog and hurricanes and rain, and so lots there. And you can join in with your own questions, and I hope you will. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Steve, I went to play golf.
What a surprise. Larry goes to play golf.
Well, it was my brother-in-law visiting from Georgia. So I took a day of vacation. And we went to the O'Hara Hills Golf Course, which is kind of a low... many low spots in it. We were, for the first tee time of the day was 7 o'clock, and it was foggy.
Yeah, yep. This is that time of year where we get a lot of fog.
Why do we get so much fog at this time of the year?
Because there are different types of fog based on basically how they're formed. In the fall, we get a lot of what we call radiation fog, and that's a situation where in the early mornings or at night, it gets cold, and as the air cools down, particularly after a rain, and we've had some good rains last week. So the soil's moisture, the low-level areas near the ground are kind of moist. And then at night, as the air cools off because the sun has set, the temperature approaches the dew point temperature. When that happens, relative humidity is 100%, and boom, you get a fog. And in the low-lying areas, you get it a lot more because the colder air is heavier, more dense, and so it tends to settle in the low spots on a golf course or...
Yeah, or anywhere else.
Or anywhere else.
Right? Yeah. The sun's up, but the fog's still there. You'd think that the sun would burn it off.
So I participated in a fog experiment, believe it or not, in Albany Airport in New York. This must have been in the early 80s. And one of the things we found in that study was that when the sun first comes up, you would expect warming, which would dissipate the fog. But what it does is it provides enough warming that you get low-level mixture. And so you're actually evaporating water that may be in the form of dew on the grass that's going into the air and actually thickening the fog. So a lot of times we found just after sunrise, those radiation fogs in particular would thicken. And then it would take about an hour or so before they would actually begin to dissipate.
Yeah, I can think of some places between Madison and Milwaukee on Interstate 94 with low spots where... Man, you're going along and it's just fine. And then suddenly you can't see.
Yes, right. And so don't slam on your brakes, right? Because there may be somebody right behind you. And that also leads to big pileups. I mean, that's when we get big pileups with fog situations like that.
People instantly slow down.
Instantly slow down, not realizing the people behind them aren't.
Somebody stopped and somebody forgot to,
kind of
thing. David in South Milwaukee has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hi. I ride my bike along the shore of Lake Michigan from South Milwaukee up to Bayview almost daily. And I can't tell you how many days I've been cold, easterly wind off the lake. And I'm thinking summer I'd get more westerly winds. Is it just me? Is there a variation in the pattern?
So what time in the morning are you biking typically?
Typically midday.
Oh, midday. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would guess what happens, because you're right. I mean, Lake Michigan is cold. And if by the time you get to midday, the land is heating up. And so we get these light breezes that go from the from the cooler lake onto the warmer land. And so it's a local effect. It's a reverse of a sea breeze. Usually, we think about, actually, it's the same. It's a lake breeze. where we're getting the breeze from the colder water onto the land. And that usually occurs midday to late day. And then oftentimes, and this happens in the ocean more, I think, than the Great Lakes, because the Great Lakes are so cold, that flow can reverse and it'll go from land out to the water.
David, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And I see somebody else is wondering, what's the difference between fog and mist?
Oh, that's a good question. And the reason why I say it's a good question, I'm not sure mist is a meteorological term or in a definition. So that's why I think, you know, mist we usually think of as a much more localized area, where fog is typically spread over a larger area. But I'm going to have to look on that.
Well, we haven't had a lot, or we haven't heard a lot about hurricanes this year, and that was interesting. I saw a piece where the forecast had been for a very active hurricane season, and here we are, and there hasn't been much.
Yeah, it was early forecast was for an active season. It's a La Nina year, and that usually means above normal type hurricanes, and I think this year, to date, we've only had three named storms.
It's not much.
Yes. It's been coming. Of course, you know, we still have a couple of months to go, 3 months to go, so there's still a chance that we'll pick up, but there's no indication that we're going to get an above average at this point.
No, and who knows how, you know, why that...
We're getting a lot of changes.
How do they predict... You know, now they were predicting a whole bunch and we didn't get it. So what were they looking at?
So in those type of forecasts, they're really looking at statistical forecasts. So they're looking at previous years, how many hurricanes do we get? And then they try to segregate it out by larger scale features that are occurring. So we know a La Nina was occurring because it was already underway. Statistically, that means we're going to have more hurricanes than average. When an El Nino is in process, then statistically we have less hurricanes in process. So it's what we call a statistical forecast, because we're not that good yet at forecasting 3 months out. So yeah. A lot of those forecasts are looking at statistical correlations.
And the El Nino, the difference between the two again, because I always get it confused myself.
So the El Nino has cooler water off of the coast of Peru on South America. La Nina has typically warmer water than normal.
And that obviously affects
and
us.
Then that affects the big circulation of global circulation, which then it determines where the hurricanes will form and move to.
And that we can predict when those years.
Yeah, and so we're pretty good at that and understanding that, which is the key. But it's just, you know, 3 month forecast. It's pretty hard to do.
Well, you think it's ever going to be possible? I can't imagine it.
You know, there's hope. You know, I think as we get better at techniques, at statistical techniques, the way that I like to think of it, and I think the way that, the National Weather Service looks at it is outlooks. You know, so what are we expecting for the outlooks for the coming winter? And so the Climate Center is looking at the outlooks for our winter. And based on statistics of what we've seen in the last year, what's expected, you know, they're basically saying it's a toss of the coin. You know, it could be above, below, or normal. You know? So there's no strong statistical signature that's going to tell you which way it's going to go.
Let's go to Dave in Monona. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks very much. I've been watching the barometric pressure on my grandfather's old barometer from Watry and Heidkamp in Chicago, and it has not varied very much at all for the last couple of weeks, maybe a couple months. And I'm just wondering if my barometer is off or if, in fact, the barometric pressure really hasn't been changing very much.
Boy, I would have expected, you know, just yesterday we had thunderstorms move in for these last couple of days, and I would have expected to see a change in pressure as that storm system moves in. Now, summertime, we have much less pressure, atmospheric pressure variations than we do in the wintertime, you know, when we have cold, really cold fronts, strong cold fronts moving through the area, which drop the pressure. So, but yeah, if it's looking fixed, you should be seeing some variation.
Yeah. How do those barometers work?
So if it's the old kind, I think it's probably one of two times. One is a coil, or another kind is a it's sort of like a container, like a can of it's much more fancier than a can of tuna, but it's a sealed can, and so as the atmospheric pressure increases, it sort of squeezes that can, which then moves the dial. So that's how those old ones tended to work.
Dave, is that what you got?
Well, it's the kind that hangs on the wall. It's quite heavy. It's made out of brass, and it's got a fancy face, and I don't know what's inside it.
Yeah, and does it have dials that would say, you know, words on it like changes expected or no rain or rain or anything like that? That's what my grandmother had. That's why I'm remembering.
Yeah, perfect. No, I haven't seen much change. There's a little needle that you can use to follow where the indicator goes, and it hasn't changed more than a couple of points.
Okay, yeah. You know, I would put it on that needle and then look for as we approach into November or December and see if it really moves very much.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah thanks a lot for calling. You expect it to move more as we get into the...
I would expect so as we get, you know, we get into November, we're getting some of those bigger frontal systems, and those frontal systems have much bigger changes in pressure than, say, a thunderstorm, which can have a big one, but it'll be a shorter time period. So in those older barometers, you may not see it move as quickly.
Phoebe in Fitchburg emailed. She was biking around the Madison Capitol Sunday, heard some thunder, so she pulled up her Weather Underground app's radar tool, and it showed open skies above her and a green and yellow weather pattern about 10 miles north. And heading north. A few minutes later, it rained cats and dogs. But it didn't last for, didn't let up for 20 minutes. So she's wondering how accurate are the real-time weather radar images?
So the real-time weather radar image that I use is directly from the National Weather Service. It's called RadarScope. It's with them working with the University of Oklahoma. And that one is accurate. And, you know, this weekend, there were some surprises in terms of precipitation that came up. I know, you know, on Saturday, we were planning a boating outing on Friday and, you know, thinking it's going to be beautiful. And then we were fortunate enough, because I had an accurate radar map, to know we need to get off the lake, which we did.
You did. And it's from, how do you get it?
It's, it's called RadarScope.
RadarScope from the National Weather Service.
Yeah, or Oklahoma University, is, you know, works together with them on that.
Okay. Steve Ackerman, our guest right now. We might find John Martin strolling in here. You never know. But at least one of our weather guys is here, Steve, and he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at climate and weather on the show right now with our two guests, our two weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Steve, of course, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education. At UW-Madison, he's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW, as is John Martin, who's joining us by phone. John, welcome.
Hey, Larry, how are you? Hi, Steve. Sorry I'm not there.
That's okay. No problem. Great to have you with us. Questions for these guys that relate to climate and weather, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. John, I'm going to go to you right away because I saw the article in this morning's Wisconsin State Journal. It was really interesting to me, and I thought, oh, man, this is perfect timing because you guys are on today. And it involved the hidden energy in rain. Can you talk about that? That was really interesting to me.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. It's something that goes on all through the year. It doesn't have to do with just rain. Sometimes when it's cold and snows, the same kinds of arguments and analysis can be made. But the water substance is the only chemical that exists in all three of its phases in the Earth's atmosphere, both invisible gas, liquid water, and solid ice. Nothing else does that. And so when you're going from one phase of the water substance to another, usually when you go from vapor to liquid, energy is released upon condensation. When you go from liquid to ice, energy is released to the environment upon freezing. And then the opposite occurs when you have to melt an ice cube or evaporate a little bit of water. So it turns out those values of energy are well known for small amounts of water. And so it just takes a little bit of multiplication to figure out if you get almost 2 inches of rain, as we did last Wednesday and Thursday, over the whole area of Dane County, which you can look up in an atlas or an almanac, and then you can figure out how much liquid water you're talking about. It had to have come originally from as much water, but in the vapor phase. And so every time a gram of water vapor is condensed into a gram of liquid water, 600 calories of energy are released. You got to multiply 600 by however many grams of water that huge amount of 2-inch depth over all of Dane County is. Turns out it's enough energy to run the whole Madison metro area, and that's the whole area, not just the city, for almost 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
Did you use your slide rule when you did this, or did you have a more sophisticated equipment?
No, just pencil and paper, and it was fun to just, start going. You do one little piece of the calculation at a time, and the numbers keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you get really excited about it, so it's pretty fun. And, of course, all that energy originally comes from the sun, and it just evaporates water all over the globe, and some fraction of that falls as precipitation as it did last Thursday on Earth. It's really cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed. So somebody might say, well, how do we harness that? But that would be a little difficult.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's nearly entirely incoherent, so we can't do much about that.
But we take advantage of some of the other energy in the atmosphere, so solar heating in general. Mm. As well as wind turbines is another way to grab some of that energy. Because as John's pointing out, there's a huge amount of energy in these storms that we just, sit on our porch and watch.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And as Steve points out, if you've got solar panels on your house, you're collecting a fraction of that enormous amount of energy every single day. So, and it's a really small fraction. So, yeah, there's plenty to be had. We just got to be intelligent and creative about how to gather it.
I guess with our new federal legislation that's gone into effect, that's probably we're going to be doing a whole heck of a lot more of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in clean energy categorized in general. And some of that can be solar, some of that can be wind, some of that can be fusion, which is related to instead of using gasoline, using different hydrogen-type fuels.
Yeah, I was visiting my sister at our old homestead the other day and realizing that the huge farm field across the street from the home is going to be all solar, farm,
wow.
Which will be kind of cool. Larry in Janesville is up with a question or comment. Larry, hi.
Hi, guys. My question is, you're talking about radar scope. What's the difference between that and your own radar in Madison at the university?
Yeah, so the radar scope is what I'll call a software package that takes the National Weather Service radar system data and puts it into a very easy-to-look imagery and access that data. We don't have a radar sitting in our campus building. We do have a radar dome, but that actually, and it was a radar dome. It used to house the radar that was out at the airport here in Madison. But underneath the one that's on our building is actually an antenna to receive satellite data because we're the birthplace of weather satellites. So we have to be able to collect all that data.
Interesting. And the radar, so the radar scope, which if somebody was tuning in later, that's an app that you feel is the most accurate.
Yeah, I think it's done really well. It'll only look at the raw data, so some of these other apps will actually merge some of the data together from the different radars that are across the country. And this one just, you know, shows it radar by radar site. And so it's a really accurate way to see what's coming at us in Madison, for example, or anywhere in Wisconsin, because there are some really good radar sites that are close to where people live.
Yeah, there we go. Scott in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Scott.
Morning, or pardon me, afternoon. This is a bit of a Monty Python question. What diameter hail overrides don't stand under a tree in a thunderstorm?
I'll give my comment, and then I'll let John talk about the hail. But if you hear a thunderstorm, you should not be under a tree, because
yeah,
that's where a lot of people, you know, the tree gets hit by lightning, travels down the trunk and across the roots. And if you're standing underneath it, you have a good chance of getting hit by that lightning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John?
Yeah.
I completely agree with that. That's the primary and perhaps only thing to consider in the face of a thunderstorm. Try not to get under a tree. But if there's no other option and you're worried about hail, I think anything bigger than pea size is going to start taking leaves and small twigs off that tree, so you're not going to find much shelter from even pea size hail in such an instance. So that's a better reason to stay away from the tree.
It's also a really good reason to have radar scope again, so
yeah,
you can look and see the storm coming at you.
There you go.
There you go, Scott. Does that help?
Oh, I knew the answer, but just had to hear it from an expert.
There we go. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Well, there was some spotty and heavy rain across the Midwest recently. Is it helping with the drought?
So it is now. If you look at the drought conditions, we're put in a normal situation. So we're normal in terms of precipitation, in terms of averaged for the month. But yeah, we've had some dry spells. I had over 2 inches at my house in this last storm that came through, I think on Saturday it was.
We had, and we're on opposite ends of town. Would John comment?
Yeah, that was very heavy rain on Saturday. I thought somewhat unexpected. I thought it was going to be more a Sunday event, and then the real downpour on Saturday caught me by surprise, and we got a pretty good amount there, too. I don't have a gauge, but because I don't have a good place to sight it. But, yeah, it was heavy rain.
Yeah, it caught us by surprise, too. We had planned on Friday to, you know, go out on the lake, and then all of a sudden we were like, you know, we should head back a little early.
That's
well,
just thinking.
There's some places like is it Texas where there's so much rain falling, just heavy amounts, and it's terrible deaths and loss of property and so forth.
Yeah, you know, and the thing about the Southwest in general is they're really still under really drought conditions, and so if you get like 2 inches of rain like we got, you know, it gets absorbed into the soil. Because we don't have that severe drought where the soil becomes really resistant to absorbing that liquid water. And so in an area where there's a strong drought, you may think 2 inches of rain is great, but if the soil is compacted, it just runs off and leads to, you know, some really bad flooding.
Yeah. And it takes a lot to fix that situation.
Yeah, you really want that more steady type of rain than the heavy downfalls.
Jill, go ahead, John.
No, I was just going to agree. It's exactly the same. I was just in New England last week, and it's been they have an extreme drought in eastern New England, and the same thing. It rained finally one day, and a fairly good amount, but you could see it was resistant to going seeping into the soil. It took a long time for any evidence of a moist soil to develop, even in the face of pretty decent rain.
Jill Nadeau sent me a little video of somebody had taken sort of a clear plastic cup of water and turned it over on sort of wet ground, and then another cup of the same cup on something in the middle, and then the cup full of water on, you know, parched earth,
yeah.
and had it so you could watch all three at the same time.
Yeah.
And man, it percolated right through on the sort of the wet ground, but it was a long, long time before that water left that cup.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if anybody who's done any gardening and hasn't, you know, watered the grass or the vegetable garden in a long time, you know, that cakiness becomes really hard to break through, and that's what that video would be demonstrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. We've got Rick in Oconomowoc. Rick, hi.
Yeah, hi. My question is on Weather Nation. They talked about the changes nationally on the coast, but also from the Gulf all the way up to the border of Wisconsin. And in the past, you've referenced the Corn Belt as an inland sea impacting weather. Can you speak to that? Is that what they're talking about, changes?
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting, the Corn Belt as being an inland sea, because when I moved here to Wisconsin and I had heard that and I was like, what do they mean by that? And who explained it to me was Professor John Norman, who's over in soil sciences. And what it is that corn transpires a lot of water. And so it takes water that's in the soil and mix it into the air up above. And there have been studies that have looked at the humidity of air that's coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, moving up the Mississippi Valley. And, you know, to me, it was hard to believe, but, you know, data is data. As it goes over the corn fields, that humidity increases, which is mind-boggling to me because we have a daughter who lives in Louisiana, and I just can't imagine, air coming off the Gulf of Mexico being any more moist than what it is. That's what they're talking about with that ocean effect.
And you're right, Steve. That's already tropical air down in New Orleans, but this stuff that comes up over Waterloo, Iowa, or Des Moines, or places like that, you know, in mid to late July, it's super tropical because it gets a boost, as you point out, from the irrigation because the corn is so bad at managing the water. So, yeah, pretty unbelievable. And that has a role to play in some of our late summer, maybe early fall thunderstorms. Certainly when the harvest begins, that's not the case. Probably even now when it's going to get tasseled, it won't matter anymore. But right about early August, the dew points can really pool, can really get high around here. And it can, if it's in conjunction with something else, get some really interesting severe weather.
Let's turn to Ricky next. Ricky, hi, thank you for calling. Oop, I guess we lost Ricky there. Well, let's see. I know we've got somebody else up here. Ralph, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question for the weather guys. We see high and low pressures follow each other around going, but they fall off the TV screen and we don't see them. Do they ever catch up with each other and neutralize each other to neutral? And the second question is, do they keep going around the world and eventually come back over our area as high and lows? That's my question.
Thank you.
Excellent question. And so, Ralph, they don't ever kind of interfere to the point where they dissipate one another, but they're a response to wave activity in the atmosphere in the middle part of the troposphere, the atmosphere that, you know, touches the Earth. And so what happens is those ones that disappear off the edge of the television screen may, in fact, die. They might just disappear off the face of the Earth, and then a new couple of systems will develop in some other part of the world, and those are the ones that might be on continuing to develop as they propagate towards us. We live in a part of the world where we get a lot of storms that are just freshly developing right in the immediate lee of the Rocky Mountains. It's especially true as the cold season approaches, that these storms won't really have any progenitor status over the Pacific Ocean or over Asia. They just kind of develop right over North America and can get going, and they may last a very long time. They may have some integrity all the way into Northern Europe and Northern Russia, so something like that during the cold season. So these storms are continuously developing, both lows and high pressure regions, and they always come in sequence, as you point out, always, 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 because of the nature of the way they develop. And so they chase each other around the globe, but they never do any self-annihilation.
Really interesting. Ralph, thank you very much for calling. Kevin in Green Bay had called in to ask if the radar scope online for $9.99 is a good one. How does it compare with the professionals?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Neither am I.
But the one now, the radar scope that you have from the Weather Service, Steve, is that a free one or is that?
Yeah, that's they have two versions. So they have the free version, which gives you, you know, the basic radar scope, and then it'll have versions which you would pay a certain annual fee for. It's still really reasonable. And that is for, you know, the weather nuts like John and I, where they will actually, you know, give you signatures of where a tornado might be falling, forming, or where there might be debris from a tornado. And that's more complex imagery that you need to kind of know what's going on.
So you're better off with I would be better off with the free version.
That's right, right. You'd be off with the free version. You could look, see where the heavy rain is, where it's red, it's really heavy, where it's purple, it's really, really heavy. And if there's a tornado coming, there's likely to be a siren going off for you to pay attention to.
I got to get that on. I got to get that on my phone. I don't have that one.
It's a really nice one. The detail is so it doesn't smooth the data route at all either. So it's very clear imagery, I think.
All right. Well, that'll be going on my phone after the show at some point.
Yeah,
while
it's a good
I'm
one.
Eating my apple. I'll put that one
up. Of course, Larry, if you. If you put that on your phone, there was one more excuse for your golf game. So that's something to consider.
That's true, because I don't know if the basic version or if the enhanced version gives you lightning strikes as well. So that's always good, too, to know that it's a thunderstorm in terms of lightning, not just the pattern.
Well, here's another whole big issue we could probably spend a lot of time on, except we've only got about 3 minutes left to talk here. But a recent study has shown that the edge of the Antarctic ice sheet has been shedding icebergs faster than the ice can be replaced. What effect, and that doesn't sound good to me, wondering what effect that is going to have on climate change.
Yeah, it's a really interesting study that I find fascinating because we see these imagery in satellite imagery where these ice sheets, you know, were in some bay, break off, then they become big icebergs and they circle the globe. What it took me a while to realize is that those big ice sheets that are connected to the continent are keeping, or like a block that's keeping the ice up above, the glaciers up above, from moving. And so once you break that off, it's like stopping a stop gate, opening up a gate. And so the glaciers that are on land can now flow out, and they flow out faster, which means the dissipation is occurring quicker.
And so what effect was that a result of climate change? And what's the impact?
It's sort of a working together. So initially, it's a global change. The warming causes those ice sheets that are floating on the ocean to break away, which then allows more of the glaciers on land to rapidly move out.
So it's not good.
So it means, right, the ice is going away faster.
And so the end result of that, I mean, how long is it going to take?
Well, there's like 6 miles of ice on Antarctica, so it'll take a while. But it just accelerates the dissipation. And once the ice sheet goes on Antarctica, you know, it increases sea level rise by a lot. And then also all that ice is really heavy. So it's pushing down the land underneath. And so you take away that ice sheet and then the land pops up. And so now we'll have more land above on Antarctica. And again, that'll take more land, same amount of water. It means it's going to increase sea level again.
Ugh. And you're saying a lot. So
a lot.
Inches.
Yeah. Inches. No, feet.
Feet?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I just read today that by 2100, at the rate at which the Greenland ice sheet is melting away, it could raise global sea level 1 foot. And that's just Greenland.
And Greenland's small in comparison to Antarctica.
And if I'm sitting on a beach in Florida with a house,
I wouldn't.
No, you'll be in frostproof Florida on the beach instead of on the coast.
Right, yeah.
The coast won't be there anymore.
Well, on that happy note, thank you guys both very much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to the last Monday of September.
Looking forward to it. We'll be really into hurricane season by then.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, right.
All right. John Martin, professor of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. One of our guests, the other, Steve Ackerman, vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW, and also a faculty member in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They will be back the last Monday of September, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow we'll have some tips for families with high school students, kids going back to school or maybe just starting high school. Then at 11:45, we'll look at what our libraries are offering in this digital age, and they're offering a whole heck of a lot. It's really going to be fascinating and fun to talk with our guests for that. In the meantime, there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler.